Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the unprecedented scientific discoveries of the Victorian era change the way people understood sacred texts and the nature of faith itself? Before modern science presented what seemed to be contradictions, it was easy for most people to believe that what the Bible said about the creation of the universe was literal fact. But by the 19th century, scientists' growing understanding of the natural world called those assumptions into question, forcing people of faith to confront and ultimately celebrate skepticism that would once have been decried as heresy. Christopher Lane is Pierce Miller Research Professor of Literature at Northwestern University and a recent Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me on.
What's so remarkable about the decades of the Victorian era is this amazing transformation people made, because early on, many people were reluctant even to associate with those who doubted the literal truth of the Bible.
That's absolutely true. The Victorians inherited a religious revival, actually, and the culture at the start of the 19th century was incredibly devout, and the Church of England in particular in Britain had a lot of power. And so the debates that were occurring over dogma, over doctrine, and the splits within the Church of England were part of the reason why that power dissipated. But there were a huge number of other influences, including the rise of geology, which could date the planet accurately, which began to challenge the narrative of Genesis, which people, as you pointed out, people had accepted very literally.
So during and after the Enlightenment, there were some church leaders in England who had redirected their efforts away from that Catholic-Protestant divide and focused on cleaving and division between believers and doubters.
Yes.
Can you talk about how that played out?
Well, what happened was, in particular in the 1860s, there was a movement to accept a more metaphorical relationship to Scripture. This was not something that was accepted lightly, and the proponents of this, they published their essays in a wonderful collection called Essays and Reviews in 1861, caused an absolute firestorm. And we forget that today, that this single collection was actually more influential on doctrine and belief than the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species two years earlier.
There is one fascinating character in the book, Bishop, I guess it's Bielby Porteous?
That's right.
He was obsessed with keeping the Sabbath holy by legal order.
That's right. This was a bishop. Initially, he was Bishop of Chester in the north of England, and he was promoted after the passage of a law which he insisted got passed in Parliament. It was called the Act for Preventing Certain Abuses and Profanations on the Lord's Day, called Sunday. This was adopted in 1781, and it actually wasn't repealed until 1972 with the Sunday Entertainment Act. And when I was growing up in London in the 60s, actually it was still technically illegal for theaters to open on Sundays. But what the law did also was throughout the 19th century, it closed libraries, museums, lecture halls, zoos, public gardens, even concerts and theaters. So the public on its day off was not allowed to go to the library, for instance. This is a way of obviously trying to affirm authority for the church and obviously keep up church attendance. And it sparked a rebellion by people who obviously were frustrated by being railroaded in that way.
Yeah, talk about, you talked about authority of the church, and obviously there were many people of faith who wanted to sort of be concerned for the souls of those around them, but there was also, I would imagine, an issue of power for the church that seemed to be slipping away during this era.
Absolutely, and this was a bishop, Bielby Porteous, who felt that loss of power very strongly, and he was answered, in fact, by a freethinker, a renowned London chemist and philosopher, William Nicholson, who wrote a pamphlet, very, very provocative and satirical pamphlet called The Doubts of Infidels, where he basically listed all the discrepancies within the Bible. He listed them chapter and verse and asked for an explanation from the bishop. And, of course, he didn't receive one. But it was a way of drawing attention to the inconsistencies in the Bible. And it sparked free thinkers who, as you say, were opposed to the authority of the church, which was trying to, in a sense, control their movements on those days. But the bishop said that there was a rise of dissipation and profaneness, a new species of it, he said, in 1780. And he was obviously responding to concern about the freethinkers who were beginning to discuss the Bible, and they were meeting particularly in London to debate it. And he wasn't happy about that. And the law was very effective in England in basically preventing those kinds of discussions. Hmm. But as John Stuart Mill pointed out halfway through the 19th century, zealots in Britain were starting to use the law to try to influence railway traveling on Sundays. And, of course, Mill, as a liberal, was very unhappy about this and described it as a form of bigotry, and said that the lack of mental freedom in the country came from the insistence by people like the bishop that humanity must be devout, must be religious, and that was a kind of imperative on the part of Christians at the time that they had to seek the conversion of others, even if they didn't want to.
And in fact, a lot of British subjects felt as if it was their duty to set a good example for the rest of this growing empire.
Well, yes, absolutely. And the rise of free thought was one way of setting that example. It was an emphasis on ethics, on justice, on reason to work through hugely divisive issues such as slavery, which Britain officially abolished in 1833, so some years before America, and obviously Brazil and other countries. And that was a point of pride at the time for the rights of men and women and for a different way of thinking about human concerns that didn't rest necessarily on theology, although it's important to state that agnosticism as a movement emerged from religious concepts such as the incarnation, for instance. It's just that very gifted thinkers such as George Eliot were adept at turning ideas such as the incarnation into human concerns, into ways of forming social bonds, creating fellow feeling and sociability, for instance. Those were very big concepts in her novels.
Was it through literature that this sort of debate filtered down to regular people?
Partly through literature, yes. I mean, I think the novel was very influential. You have, for instance, Charles Dickens, an enormously popular novelist, of course, with caricatures of firebrand evangelicals such as Chadband in Bleak House. And you have more moderate but still very critical portrayals of let's say religious hypocrites such as Bulstrode in Eliot's Middlemarch, and their ways of sort of in the novels of accenting a gap between the professed beliefs of the statements of belief by those religious figures and the way that they actually behave.
We should say, I mean, clearly people must have had questions, even the most faithful among us must have had questions throughout history. This was just the first time that anyone was speaking about it out loud?
Well, this was the first moment when there was really a mass move toward asking those questions. In the 18th century, the previous century, you have people like David Hume, part of the Scottish Enlightenment, writing incredibly interesting, powerful essays, say, on miracles, which weren't published until much later. And even the drafts that were circulated were sufficient for the Church of Scotland to consider charging him with heresy. What he was doing was basically advancing an argument that miracles should be judged according to rational standards of proof. And, of course, the church was very opposed to that measurement and wanted to insist that they remain supernatural events or miraculous events. But what happened was partly through, the rise of free thought, partly from sort of reaction to the behavior of the church, which was trying to quash such dissent, and partly from the fact that the rise of geology and paleontology and botany and these new sciences were capable of dating the planet, for instance, far more accurately than ever before, identifying fossils and dating them too, understanding principles of transmutation in the plant world and the animal kingdom. And it was slowly impossible for the church to avoid public interest in those kinds of issues. And there was, long before Darwin, in fact, a very strong movement to consider evolution as God-ordained, as a principle that was perfectly compatible with God-given laws. This was something the theists took up. But it was also an opportunity for, let's say, working-class thinkers to oppose the established order, which Christianity had assumed through the church, through the crown, and then the bishops, and the church hierarchy. Evolution complicated that principle very much, and it set off fantastic debates in across the country long before Darwin. But then when Darwin famously came and his book was debated by the Bishop of Oxford in 1860 and so on, that's really when it took off as a mass movement, and it became impossible to avoid, and the church was sort of forced to debate it and confront it, and the church found that evidence was really not in its favor at that point.
Christopher Lane is my guest. He's Pierce Miller Fellow, a research professor of literature at Northwestern University and a recent Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a break here for a couple of minutes and remind you that we are in our spring fundraising campaign. The money that you contribute to this station makes it possible for us to exist and bring you this kind of programming every day, which we know is unduplicated anywhere in North Texas. Perhaps if you listen to the podcast or online, you think it's unduplicated anywhere. We're really proud of that, and we appreciate your support with your dollars at kera.org and at 1-888-694-6931. Hey, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd. Just to be technically accurate, Chris and I would still exist, even if
we would exist.
Right,
yes.
The station,
but the show
only
wouldn't exist without your
right.
Without your
the
dollars.
Station only exists. Yes, you're not conjuring Chris Boyd when you call in and give $35.
I kind of feel like
station.
I live for my job, though.
But you know, it does really make a huge difference when you call 888-694-6931, or when you contribute at kera.org. As a matter of fact, I'd encourage you to contribute at kera.org because it actually saves the station a little bit of money when you contribute online. The processing of your contribution is a lot cheaper for KERA. Well, it's a little bit cheaper, but when you think about the fact
couple dollars here and there.
Yeah, that we're hoping to hear from 6,000 people during this membership campaign, it adds up. So please do your part online at kera.org. If that's not possible, call us, 888-694-6931. I want to thank Ramez Elmazri in Arlington, Cheryl Harding in Dallas. We heard also from Robin Corvar in Dallas. Thank you so much to each of you. Why not be the next one?
If you are ready to make a contribution at or above the $120 level, you might choose a copy of The Age of Doubt, Christopher Lane's new book that's available as a thank you gift. You can find this when you go online or also if you call. Again, the online place is, as always, kera.org. If it's better for you to call, you can do that at 1-888-694-6931.
Online at kera.org or 888-694-6931. Don't forget, there are drawings for the iPad 2 every day for the first 9 days of the campaign. This is the second day, so if you enter today, you'll get in more drawings than if you enter
eight
tomorrow.
Eight chances, right?
That's right. Go online to kera.org. You can read the rules. Of course, you don't have to make a contribution, but we hope that you will when you're there.
Your contribution to KERA is a contribution not only to the programming that you love, but also to the entire community. It really is putting your money to work here in this community for a station that serves you and your neighbors and your family every day of the year. We'd love to hear from you now at kera.org with a contribution at any level. You can also get to us by phone at 1-888-694-6931. Back in a minute with Christopher Lane.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pierce Miller, research professor of literature at Northwestern University and a recent Guggenheim fellow, Christopher Lane. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. You can be part of this conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. You mentioned that as the 19th century progressed, we understood better and better how old the Earth was. Can you talk a little bit about the work of geologist James Hutton?
Yes. Hutton was technically a uniformitarian. He was someone who opposed the idea that a flood was responsible for creating our landscape, our continents, and so on. What he saw by studying the tides and the sort of minute sedimentation, the sort of leaving behind of sediment and then the washing away of part of it by wave action, was the accretion of land. And this was obviously centuries before plate theory, the understanding of tectonic plates today, which obviously have created mountain ranges such as the Andes and the Himalayas and the Alps, which couldn't have been created in that way. But what Hutton discovered, and he was disconcerted by this, was simply that one couldn't put a date stamp on the planet if that movement, the sort of gradual buildup of land, the slow washing of it away in other parts, was sort of occurring over millennia. Then the idea that in Genesis that one could establish an origin for that sort of disappeared, and he has this very poetic statement about we find no beginning, no prospect of an end. It's a way of saying that movement continues without us and with us, and it's going to go on regardless. And that was very disconcerting for someone like him who really fiercely wanted to believe. And you have a similar quandary with other geologists such as Sir Charles Lyell, who was a Unitarian, someone who believes in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost being one, who was very disconcerted by all the principles of geology, transmutation and evolution that were then being fiercely debated.
So instead,
it became a kind of biblical furore, if you like, the effort to reconcile the two. And again, for Lyell, someone very devout found against his wishes that he couldn't do so. It was just sort of impossible for him to reconcile the two. He had to create a more sort of lateral, poetic relationship to his beliefs.
Talk a little bit about William Buckland, who was, it's an interesting career split. He was a paleontologist, but he was also a minister.
Yes, he was. And he was someone, he was appointed to the first chair of geology at Oxford University, which was momentous for the time. The Prince Regent had endowed this chair, and so it was sort of tied to the monarchy. And all the bigwigs in Oxford sort of showed up for his inaugural lecture. And it was there, he was a very colorful character, and he wore sort of outlandish clothes and was supposed to be a very gifted speaker. And he insisted that he wasn't going to antagonize the church by saying geology was going to contradict Genesis. At the same time, what he did was very ingenious, was sort of formalize what's been known as gap theory, which is to say between the first and second verses of Genesis, there's no specification of time. And for Buckland, that was an opportunity to say, actually, we could have an enormous period of time here, deep time, without needing to think of this literally as one day. And so that was one way that he got around sort of those sort of big conundrums for scientists at the time.
Was that something that Buckland seems to have agonized over in order to come up with that solution, or did it simply make sense to him from the beginning?
Well, I think there was less agony on that part. There was, I think, on his part, obviously very strong beliefs and really an idea through Paley that science had to adapt to fit the biblical narrative. And at that point, in the 18-teens, it was still possible to persuade people of that without too many questions being asked. I mean, I think there were skeptics, but he seemed to satisfy the administration at Oxford. They were quite happy with his inaugural lecture.
Along the way, you have all of these ideas about science and faith working their way into explorations through art and literature, so that you have, for example, Percy Shelley glorifying the beauty of nature and the wilderness, but not specifically God.
Yes, absolutely. And I write about his beautiful poem, Mont Blanc, about the highest peak in the French Alps, where he's working with Hutton, talking about ancient power of an earthquake demon, as he says, that may have been responsible for the whole thing. Shelley was himself someone who was kicked out of Oxford University for writing a thesis called The Necessity of Atheism. This is something he wrote in 1811, and he said, God is an hypothesis, and as such stands in need of proof. And for that, my students today were aghast to hear that he was rejected. He was asked to leave Oxford, and this was sort of published subsequently. But he was a free thinker, and he was an unbeliever, and he writes this poem to talk about the principle of doubt, among many other things, and to give it kind of due accord in poetry and in thinking. And it's a very beautiful meditation on the need for doubt and the kind of payoff of it in terms of our having a more open-minded relationship to our history and to the planet's history.
Shelley was asked to leave Oxford, but in fact, in the 18th century in England, it was still possible to be hanged for blasphemy. Is that right?
Well, actually, slightly earlier. I think the last dated hanging was in 1696. This was Thomas Aikenhead in Edinburgh, Scotland, whose crime has been recorded as denying the doctrine of the Trinity. So he was a Unitarian, and for failing to be a Trinitarian, he was hanged, which is an extraordinary and very unbelievable situation for us to contemplate today. But I think it gives the sort of baseline to the sense of the provocation of what was deemed heresy or blasphemy at the time, that people weren't allowed to depart from doctrine, that if they did so, they were taking enormous risks. So this was a way, really, to underscore just how difficult it was to voice even mild doubts about Christianity at the time. You really had to accept it hook, line, and sinker. And for thinkers, for intellectuals, for writers and poets who were dealing with big questions of their own, this was very troubling, because it basically it sort of coerced their thinking along grooves that they weren't inclined to take.
We have an email here from Jerry, who writes, I would submit the downturn of classical church belief sets came far before the 18th century with Copernicus. How was what happened during the Victorian era different from that upheaval?
Well, of course, Copernicus introduced a massive upheaval. He wasn't widely accepted for that upheaval at the time. In fact, was obviously punished very, very severely for it. What I think happens in the Victorian period is you've got, obviously, with the Enlightenment, you've got the beginnings of a strong reaction to such doctrine. But it's really with the rise of the young sciences such as geology and paleontology and botany and biology that one can systematically sort of trace the divergence between doctrine, between theology, and the young sciences based on evidence, based on proof. And, you know, as we've been discussing, there were very pronounced attempts to reconcile the two, to make it seem as if they agreed with each other. But the scientific evidence by that point was just simply too overwhelming. So it's sort of like an incremental, if you like, an incremental move until it reaches a tipping point. And I would say the tipping point was somewhere around the 1840s.
Talk about 1844. You have this journalist, he wrote anonymously, but Robert Chambers wrote this book called The Vestiges of a Natural History of Creation.
Yes. This is an extraordinary book. As you point out, he didn't put his name to it. He was a Scots author and publisher and journalist, and he argues in this book, which we have to state, caused a sensation at the time. I mean, it was a bestseller on both sides of the Atlantic and across Europe. And you've got Queen Victoria and Abraham Lincoln and Ralph Waldo Emerson sort of clamoring for copies, and it's influencing George Eliot and Alfred Tennyson and a lot of the big thinkers at the time. He argues in that book that the progressive evolution of species is entirely compatible with God-given laws. So he's taking a deist perspective, which is essentially that God creates the world and then leaves it to evolve on its own. And that's a position that a number of free thinkers adopted as a sort of halfway house, if you like, before full-blown doubt or atheism. And the public initially was completely fascinated by this. In fact, the response to the book was so overwhelming. You've got sort of dinner party conversations about it. You've got a huge amount of newspaper column inches devoted to the book. And then all of a sudden, the church begins to worry that this is actually contradicting many of its own positions. And then you have a concerted attempt by some scientists also to sort of intervene and say, don't follow this path. We cannot allow for evolution in this form. This doesn't sound compatible with our own doctrine. And so there was an effort to denounce him as an atheist. And it's possible that his deism was strategic, that he was adopting it to, as it were, to provoke or goad or stimulate the church into some kind of response. But it was definitely incredibly powerful. Long before, 15 years before Darwin's treatise came out, it was really a way of opening the conversation on evolution, which you know, left the lab, as it were, the scientist lab, and entered the Victorian home. It was something that families would discuss and talk about quite openly.
Christopher Lane is my guest. He's professor of literature at Northwestern and a recent Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. We'll resume our conversation with Chris in just a minute and welcome you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. I'm joined now by the senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, Jeff Whittington. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We are giving you this opportunity right now. It's sort of a show-free opportunity, so you don't miss anything, to call the station, 888-694-6931, or to go online and make a contribution at kera.org, because you value this program, you value these kinds of conversations, and you want them to continue right here in North Texas. I mean, we make these decisions about what's going to be on the show, what we're going to cover, who we're going to talk to, with you in mind every single day. And your support over the years, or maybe for the first time today, at KERA.org is what makes it all possible.
We love to hear from you. We love your financial support and appreciate it at whatever level you can give, whether it's a few dollars a month or a few thousand dollars a year. However, if you want to make a contribution right now at or above the $120 level, we do have copies of The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. That's by our guest for this hour, Christopher Lane. Those are available at the $120 level or above. You can receive your copy by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931 to make your contribution.
You can join the station with a $10 a month transfer as a sustaining member, and you can pick up that copy of The Age of Doubt for yourself. Or, you know, there are a number of other ways that we can say thanks. There's the really fantastic Ken Burns' The Civil War series, which is, it's back. It's been updated slightly with some new material, and it's a 5-DVD set. It's available when you join the station today at the $100 membership level. That's a great deal. And marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War here recently in the United States, it's timely as well. So just like the public radio news and information and reports you hear on the news magazines, the interviews you hear on shows like Think or The Diane Rehm Show or Fresh Air with Terry Gross, it's right there in, you know, it's timely and it makes sense. And, you know, supporting the station makes sense.
If you call or go online today, we still have, you'll still get 8 chances to win the Apple iPad 2. We have drawings for each of the next 8 days. You don't have to make a contribution. We know that most of you will want to when you do call or go online, but want to let you know about that. The sooner you get in, the more chances you'll have to win. We would love for you to take that home and also to support the station with your dollars. It's very important that the local community, that North Texas and any of you who listen to this program support this program. It's certainly a sign of your support, of your interest, of your enthusiasm for the kind of programming that we're able to bring you, thanks in large portion to your generosity.
89% of the budget for this station comes from listeners, corporations, foundations, and other local entities here in North Texas who believe in the mission of KERA. 61% of the station's budget, by far the lion's share, comes directly from your contributions. Individual contributions make up that huge a part of the budget that runs this radio station, that funds it, that makes it possible for us to acquire programming and produce programming like The Think Show right here in North Texas. So please think for a moment about what life would be like without public radio in North Texas, and then make the decision to go online to KERA.org and make a gift of support to the station, or make a contribution via the phone by calling 888-694-6931. And don't forget, you can get your very own copy of Christopher Lane's book, The Age of Doubt, when you join the station at the $120 membership level.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Our favorite way to receive your contributions is online at KERA.org, but we know not everybody's in front of a computer. If you think you might forget to go back to your computer later, by all means, please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. You can make a contribution with a credit card, with your debit card. You can also set up the sustaining membership program, which a lot of people find is a great way to make a significant gift to the station without taking what feels like a heavy bite out of your budget, because it happens every month. There's a draw from your checking account into our membership account.
But please do it now, because you're listening right now, and we have the opportunity to remind you of how important your support is right now. You may not be listening later, and we may not have the opportunity right then to remind you. Yeah, that it's important. And we really would love to hear from you today. It is really crucial that you go online to KERA.org or call 888-694-6931.
Remember, again, we have copies of Christopher Lane's new book, The Age of Doubt, available at or above the $120 contribution level. We would love to hear from you with a contribution of $120, of less, of more, whatever works within your budget. The way to get in touch with us right now is to go online to KERA.org or to call 1-888-694-6931. We'll resume our conversation with Chris Lane in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Lane. He is Pierce Miller Research Professor of Literature. I don't know why I can't pronounce that, at Northwestern University, also a recent Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. We do have phone lines open now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Chris, we've talked about how Robert Chambers and others throughout this period created a much more hospitable space for those who doubted the literal truth of the Bible and in some cases ultimately lost their faith. Did it also, this period, change the way people who maintained their religious traditions thought about their own doubts and sort of accepted them as part of the practice of their faith?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that happened with the promotion of these kinds of discussions was a great deal of discussion within Christianity itself, among the various schools, if you like, or denominations. And there was one of the things that I do in the book, which I think is fairly unusual, is sort of retrace the arguments of a lot of the periodical literature on both sides of the Atlantic, where you have just basically an explosion of interest in the topic. It becomes a sort of feature of sermons in a way more than ever before. partly because it's being recognized as something that's being discussed so openly in the culture. And I think what happens is a growing liberalization, if you like, of the Christian denominations on both sides of the Atlantic, but particularly in Britain, where, as I said earlier, the publication of this single book, Essays and Reviews, in 1860-61, was responsible for just sort of opening a floodgate of questions about the miracles, about the resurrection, about the virgin birth, about the flood, and so on, where you have very senior scholars at Oxford, classicists like Benjamin Jowett, basically saying, we need to approach these, or we recommend that we approach these miracles with, quote, the latitude of poetry, which is to say, think about them as symbols, think about them as allegories and metaphors, extended metaphors, but to insist that they have a kind of unchanging truth across the centuries, across the ages, is unrealistic. And, of course, many believers were very unhappy to hear this. But the kind of emphasis on the latitude of poetry, which is right there in the Bible, I mean, the opening book of Genesis, you have beautiful lines like, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. These are very strong poetic figures, and you can see how strongly they move people. At the same time, for intellectuals, for people sort of intent on establishing empirical truths about the history of the planet and so on, they're not reliable. And that was one of the big problems. They were sort of decreasingly real for large numbers of believers. So the church adapted, particularly in England, by accepting metaphor in a way that the evangelical movements in the States fiercely resisted. And what you have there is a sort of doubling down on scripture as the word, as a sort of unchanging word. And what happens then is that any kind of contradiction or inconsistency in the Bible is sort of redounds upon the questioner as a problem. You simply don't have enough faith. I think in comparing the two countries, obviously I'm from Britain. I've lived in the States for 24 years now. I could have a sense of how metaphor could be far more inducive to a more relaxed relationship to scripture than many Americans want. In fact, in this country, according to the Gallup poll in last December, 4 in 10 Americans believe now in strict creationism, which is, I think, rather worrying insofar as this is an insistence that the planet is only as old as scripture basically tells us it is, or can be, which is around 6,000 years, and that we've descended from one human pair, which is, you know, completely improbable. Nonetheless, 4 in 10 Americans is something like 120 million Americans to this day adhere very strongly to that principle, and the majority of Republicans adhere to it. And this is starting to have, I think, a very sort of pronounced effect on social policy, on textbook choices. I know in Texas there's been a big battle over not just American history, but how science is treated. It's as if the Scopes trial from Tennessee that officially ended in 1967 is still being fought in parts of this country, and I think that's a big mistake. I think it's, you know, as a teacher, I have big concerns about this for the next generation and the current generation, who need to be competitive in a globalized market and need to treat science with a full sense of its complexity, rather than simplifying it by saying it has to accord with scripture. There's one reason I wrote this book, was just to sort of remind people we've had these debates. They're not new, and they were very intelligently discussed in the 19th century, and very strong believers reluctantly conceded that they couldn't adopt the same literalist faith any longer, but they could continue their beliefs, obviously, by allowing them to be somewhat more capacious through metaphor. And I think a number of Christians in this country have found that. Obviously, that's not new, but I'm still worried about the literalists, the 120 million Americans believing in strict creationism against all odds, against all scientific evidence. They persist in that. I think that's troubling for this, for the future of this country.
Well, let me ask you this, Chris, because one might hope that the pendulum would swing again, simply to the extent that we have at least a tolerance for doubt in our society. You know, people may hold very strong beliefs one way or another, but the idea that the doubt is a healthy thing and skepticism is a healthy thing on all sides is a good thing. But in the Victorian era, what you didn't yet have was the assumption that that religion and science had to be far apart and in different corners. You know, people were such polymaths that you can have someone who was both a paleontologist and an influential minister. We don't really have that today.
Sorry, I missed that last part.
We don't have that today, that ability for people to move equally comfortably in both circles.
That's true. I think that's true. People feel sort of locked in certain corners, and the perspective has become very polarizing. I mean, we have Koran burners sort of acting in the name of Christianity. We have new atheists sort of saying, you know, faith is a delusion, like a sort of psychiatric disorder. And that's not helpful either. I mean, it's just the kind of chasm between the two is incredibly unhelpful. So what I tried to do in the book is sort of modulate between these positions to say it actually is possible to, not exactly to reconcile the two systems, but to narrow the gap between them, to say, you know, the contrast between creed or chaos, for instance, that David Brooks wrote about recently in the New York Times, is a false choice. We don't have to think of chaos as the opposite of creed. We can think of free thought. We can think of ethics. We can think of justice and humanism as an alternative, and a very vibrant and robust one. So, absolutely, I'm arguing that doubt is healthy, that discussion is healthy, that sort of doubling down on unrealistic positions and improbable positions is not, and it's leading to a kind of chasm which is quite worrying in this country.
We just have less than a minute left, but I want to ask you, since we didn't get into this, and there's so much great stuff in the book about the Bronte family and their contributions, can you give us some ideas about what to read that's maybe not in the canon of you know, Jane Eyre that people might want to explore?
Well, I was going straight to Jane Eyre, actually, and I think the new film version of that that novel is fantastic. It's definitely worth seeing. I've strong interest in the book, in obviously this unread classic, Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, which is, you know, was a bestseller, is a fantastic read. It's not fiction, but it's still enormously readable. It's been reprinted by the University of Chicago Press. I recommend that people go back to John Stuart Mill's Treatise on Liberty. It's very current. It's very topical for libertarians, for independents, for liberals. It's a very strong defense of free thoughts. And he argues basically true freedom consists in pursuing one's own good in one's own way as long as it does not prevent others from doing the same, which is a very powerful argument at the time against sort of what he thought as a sort of intrusions of religious bigotry, the insistence that one's fellow man be religious, which was a big problem for him. But the Bronte sisters, Tennyson, George Eliot, I write about both Middlemarch and Silas Marner, which is a wonderful short novel by her on the sort of implications of lost faith and the implications of finding fellowship in other forms. It's very powerful. I think that's a good start.
That's a good start. Maybe we'll start with your book and then go back to all those wonderful works. Christopher Lane is professor of literature at Northwestern and a recent Guggenheim Fellow. His new book is called The Age of Doubt, Tracing the Roots of Our Religious Uncertainty. Chris, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. We appreciate all of you who are listening right now, all of you who perhaps spend many lunch days with us. Maybe you're at the office with a sandwich. Maybe you're in your car. Maybe you're at home. But we know how many of you find time each day between noon and 2 to join us for this show. We're really proud to be able to serve you, and we feel very privileged. It's possible because of your financial support, your support at kera.org and also at 1-888- 888-694-6931. The money that you send us pays for things as simple as the programming itself. It pays for, you know, electricity. It gives our journalists supplies to go out and do things. It, you know, pays the phone bill that we speak to many of our guests, of course, on long distance call. And of course, it allows for us to bring you all the great programs that you love from NPR and PRI and the other services that come from other places. So your support is greatly appreciated. And we want to thank Rajesh and Rekha Nidwanya in Plano, James Woods in McKinney, and Petra Yassin in Dallas.
Also, Patricia McArdle in Irving, Diane Risser in Dallas, Jackie Otto in Keller, and Craig and Jill Madinis in Flower Mound. Thanks so much to each of you. You can join these fine folks in support of your public radio station. They're paying for the station for you right now, and you can help offset that cost for them and everyone else by making your contribution online at kera.org or on the telephone. Just call 888-694-6931.
We know that this station is different from anything else that you can turn on the broadcast dial here in North Texas. There's nothing wrong with the products that anybody else puts out. But if you want this sort of content, KERA is your one option. We are pleased to be able to bring it to you. We're pleased to have an audience, honestly, who loves the same things that we do. We, Jeff and I, are listeners as much as we are participants in producing the programming. We love it, too. We're members of the station. And it's always astonishing how much you show us that you care about this programming by giving money at whatever level you can afford at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Being a loyal listener is great. Being a supporter makes the programming possible.
Having more listeners get involved and make that membership investment in the station makes for a good business practice for KERA. We want the station to be stable. We want it to be secure, and we want to be able to meet our obligations here so that we can continue to serve you with programming like the show we just had and the show we have in the next hour. Public radio is a partnership between you and the people that work here and the organization and the national organization. And everybody comes together to make sure that you have the news coverage unlike anything else on your radio dial. And KERA is a big part of that. And you know what? You're the biggest part of that because you make it possible when you contribute at kera.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931.
You remember what we're talking about next hour, right?
Yeah.
Wild boars.
Yeah.
This is the thing I love about serving you, our audience, is that Jeff and I are kind of nerdy and we get all excited about these things, but you come right along with us. And I was telling my mother about this last night, and she said, how are you going to talk about that for an hour? And I'm thinking, gosh, I wish I had three, because it's really surprisingly interesting topic. And it actually has, this guy's from, he lives in France, but it has huge repercussions here in Texas, which is cool. And it's also nice for us to be able to talk about global things, but allow you to be the primary people, you here in North Texas, to respond to all of these very distinguished guests that we're able to bring you.
Yeah, you make it possible. I mean, you help create the reality that gives you the opportunity to interact with guests on the show and on other shows like the Diane Rehm Show when you contribute at kera.org or when you make a contribution on the phone at 888-694-6931. This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, online at kera.org. Also 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202DR Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman.
We talk about public radio being a partnership. We wouldn't need to exist if you didn't want this content. We wouldn't be able to exist if your support were not with us. You keep public radio strong and vibrant. We work very hard to stretch the dollars that you send us just as far as they will possibly go. The very last thing we want to sacrifice is the programming that you rely on every day. And, you know, there's some programs that you absolutely need, maybe the news programs. There are other programs like, you know, Car Talk on the weekends or This American Life, things that you just like to listen to that enhance the quality of your life. We are delighted to be that source of programming for you. You are our major source of funding.
Yeah, when you make a contribution, you're ensuring that those shows and this show and all the shows you listen to on KERA are here for you every single day and every single week. Please don't expect that someone else will do it. And please make the contribution right now, because you might be, you know, in a moment in the day right now where you can listen and you're listening to us, and we're able to remind you that it's really important that you support the station. You know, in 15 minutes or an hour from now, you may not be listening, or you may not be in a position where you're able to be reminded that it's important. We know that all of you great KERA listeners out there have the best of intentions, and everybody wants to do their part. But that's why right now is the moment. I would encourage you to go right now to KERA.org or to call 888-694-6931.
You can make a contribution with a debit card, with a credit card. You can also set up a sustaining membership. As we've explained in the past, what that is basically instead of giving a certain amount once a year, you have a monthly draw from your checking account. Lots of folks like that because, for one thing, it's always set up and you don't have to worry about it. For another thing, you can often make a pretty significant contribution without having it really feel like so much out of your budget. If you want to make a contribution today at or above the $120 level, you can receive a copy of Chris Lane's book, Age of Doubt. You can get in touch with us and make your contribution at KERA.org.
Engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at KERA.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.